the sacrifice being vastly superior, and that sacrifice establishing a superior covenant. And then we may get into chapter 11 and sort of the beginning of his final practical push to get them to remain faithful. In 10:1 through 4, we saw that the blood of bulls and goats was never going to be able to take away sins. The emphasis at this point being on the fact that they continue to be offered, but he has offered a one-time, a once-for-all kind of sacrifice. And then he quotes from Psalm 46 through 8, and the quotation reads a little bit differently than our Old Testament, which is based on the Masoretic text. He's quoting from the Septuagint. It has "a body you have prepared for me," which is kind of a key idea here. And that, unlike the sacrifices that God didn't accept in the sense of them taking away sins, Jesus has offered one sacrifice for all time in fulfillment of this and many other passages. Then in 11, he talks about the fact that every priest stands ministering daily. Again, they're continually offering these sacrifices. He offered one sacrifice for sins for all time. And having offered that one sacrifice, he sat down at the right hand of God in fulfillment of the 110th Psalm. As a priest who has completed his sacrificial service, and as a king, although that point is not being emphasized here. And he's perfected for all time those who are sanctified. And so he goes back to Jeremiah 31, 31, 34. Now, in consequence, we have confidence to enter into the holy place. And where is our confidence? Yeah, it's in Christ and in his sacrifice. That is the basis of our confidence. They were reminded of their sins. We, because of the nature of this sacrifice, we have confidence to enter into the presence of God, knowing that those sins have been taken out of the way. And so we need to draw near. We need to not run away from God. God did all this so that we could draw near. And so the only reasonable response to such a great gift is to, in fact, draw near with a sincere heart in the full assurance of faith, because our hearts have been sprinkled clean from an evil conscience. And we need to hold fast to that confession of hope, to the belief that through Jesus Christ our hopes will be realized. Don't let go of that for anything. Don't allow anything that's going on in this world, because the things of this world can't take away that hope. Because where is our confidence? Not what is our confidence, but where is our confidence? It's sitting at the right hand of God, right? So nothing that happens down here can impact that in any way, unless something that happens down here causes us to forsake our hope. But short of that, nothing's gonna undo what has been done once for all. And nothing can take away what Christ has done. Nothing can undo what Christ is doing. He tells us to hold fast to our hope. He tells us to consider how to stimulate one another to love and good works, not forsaking our assembling together, but encouraging one another. And if we forsake that, if we don't do that, if we go on sinning willfully, then we don't have a sacrifice for sins anymore. We've forsaken the only thing that can save us. And he says in no uncertain terms that the punishment will be even more severe than it would have been for someone who rejected the picture or the type. It will be more severe for the one who has trampled underfoot the Son of God and regarded as unclean the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified and insulted the Spirit of grace. And so he says, "Don't, please, please, please do not treat the cross and what was done on the cross with contempt. It is vastly superior to any of the other sacrifices." And we know the kinds of things that happened when people treated what was going on in the tabernacle lightly, or the sacrifices were treated in some way lightly. And you think about, there are many occasions, Nadab and Abihu, Saul, who treated the sacrifices lightly when he didn't wait for Samuel. He went on to offer the sacrifice himself. He lost the kingdom. Various other occasions when people didn't have proper regard for what was going on in the tabernacle or the temple. It doesn't ever end well. And so how much more? Again, it's the same argument he made at the beginning in chapter 2 when he said, if the word spoken through angels proves steadfast and every infraction there received a just penalty, how much more will the word spoken through the Lord? Same kind of thing here. Very same argument that we saw in chapter 2. And he then begins to look to a series of scriptures that I want us to think about the context of as we kind of work through this. And we touched on this just a little bit last time. But in verse 27, he talks about a terrifying expectation of judgment and the fury of fire which will consume the adversaries with regard to those who go on sinning willfully. If you would go back with me to Isaiah chapter 26. And let's look at some of this. In Isaiah 26:11, O Lord, your hand is lifted up, yet they do not see. They see your zeal for the people and are put to shame. Indeed, fire will devour your adversaries or your enemies, which is the quotation that he makes. But then he goes on to say, Lord, you will establish peace for us, since you have also performed for us all our works. O Lord, our God, other masters besides you have ruled us, but through you alone we confess your name. The dead will not live, the departed spirits will not rise. Therefore you punished and destroyed them. You have wiped out all remembrance of them. You have increased the nation, O Lord. You have increased the nation. You are glorified. You have extended all the borders of the land. And one of the points that's being made in this context, in the context prior to verse 11 as well, if you read the first part of the chapter, the same point is made. And that is, in all of these passages the Hebrew writer is going to look at, have this kind of background to them. He'll pull out one little phrase, but they all emphasize the fact that God is going to punish the wicked. But all of those statements are drawn from context where he's also taught, where it also speaks about him taking care of and delivering the righteous. And I don't think that's an accident. I mean, there are plenty of passages that really just, the immediate context is only talking about punishing the wicked. There are plenty of passages he could have gone to that just emphasize that. I think it's interesting that he looks at a series of Old Testament passages that both talk about, in the immediate context, they talk about God punishing the wicked and caring for the righteous. Because the Hebrew writer is interested in his audience doing a couple of things, okay? Number one, he is interested in them not repeating the mistakes of the past, okay? Alan did a really good job back when he taught the class about emphasizing the fact that the generation that came out of Egypt and died in the wilderness is sort of the Hebrew writer's foil. They're his villains. They represent everything that's sort of wrong with God's people. And so he wants to remind them not to make that kind of mistake again. Don't do what they did. And not only what they did, but many others like them after them have done. Don't repeat the mistakes of your forefathers. So, because if you do, you know what the outcome's going to be. If you don't know by now, you're never going to know. Okay? Died in the wilderness. Driven into Assyrian captivity. Driven into Babylonian captivity. Struck down over and over and over again. If you hadn't figured that out yet, okay, then you're really not paying attention. But the flip side is that he also wants them to remember that God is a God who delivers his people in and from difficult circumstances. That is, there is also a long history of God's people being persecuted, of them suffering, and God bringing them through that to ultimate glory. And all of these passages talk about that in some way, shape, or form. So even though he's just pulling a phrase out, it's from a context that's got both things on offer in every case. And we'll, as we sort of work through this part of Hebrews, we're going to be going back and we're going to be picking that up. But that's certainly true in Isaiah 26. Any thoughts before we move on? Okay. He says, anyone who set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. We've already talked a little bit about that. How much severe punishment do you think he will deserve as trampled underfoot the Son of God and has regarded as unclean the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified and has insulted the Spirit of grace? That language, insulted the Spirit of grace, is similar to language, and this isn't up there, it's not a direct quotation, but in Isaiah 63, Isaiah 63 beginning in verse 9, Isaiah is reflecting back on the generation that was brought out of Egypt, the generation that the Hebrew writer talked about back in Hebrews 3 and 4. He says, in all their affliction he was afflicted, and the angel of his presence saved them. This is Isaiah 63:9. In his love and in his mercy he redeemed them, and he lifted them and carried them all the days of old. But they rebelled and what? Grieved his Holy Spirit. Exactly. They grieved his Holy Spirit. They violated the holiness of God. And so he uses very similar language here. He says, don't insult the Spirit of grace. Don't do that. That's okay. He's going to argue that just as Christ is officiating in the actual tabernacle, in the actual presence of God. He's going to argue that we too have a part in the actual tabernacle of God. He's going to talk about us later on having a right to eat from the altar, which they have no right to eat, which others have no right to eat from. He's going to talk about us offering up sacrifices, the sacrifice of praise of our lips when we get into the end of the book. And so he's going to talk about our priestly role later on in the book. And the one thing we don't want to do is insult the one who dwells in the temple, God, by rejecting the gracious sacrifice that he has made for us and rejecting the grace that comes from that sacrifice. And so don't make that mistake again. And all of this is thinking, because if we think about them thinking about going back, the Hebrew writer in one sense, in one way, is saying, you need to be careful what you go back to. Because there were some other go-backers in history. And what they were wanting to go back to was Egypt. You don't want to be like the other go-backers when you think about going back. If you want to go back to something, go back to the example of faith. Now, that's chapter 11, I understand, but we're moving in that direction. He's going to give them something legitimate to go back to that will move them forward toward Christ. But he says, don't. What you're thinking about going back to is the wrong thing to go back to. That's sort of moving his argument down the field. And then he says, we know him who said, vengeance is mine, I will repay. Now that is a quotation from Deuteronomy 32, 35 and 36. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 32 again and look at this. Look at a little bit of this context, not a lot. I'm just going to start in Deuteronomy 32:34. Is it not laid up in store with me, sealed up in my treasuries? Vengeance is mine. Okay, that is the quotation. Vengeance is mine. And retribution. In due time, their foot will slip, for the day of their calamity is near, and the impending things are hastening upon them. For the Lord will vindicate his people and will have compassion on his servants when he sees that their strength is gone and there is none remaining, bond or free. Now, again, notice, not only do we have this idea of, vengeance on the one hand, judgment on one hand, and salvation on the other, but what kind of people are being saved or delivered in Deuteronomy 32:36? Servants, and what are their conditions? Okay, that's right. They're weak. They're oppressed. And vindication indicates that they're suffering at the hands of their enemies. Okay? And so the Hebrew writer is, again, this is just a masterful use of these Old Testament passages, because he's saying, look, if you leave the Lord, you're joining the losing side, number one, and you're going to be an object of vengeance. But you joined the enemy. You haven't joined God's people. You joined the enemy of God's people. And that's got an outcome. Now, I understand you're being oppressed and you're being afflicted. I get that. But those are the people. It's the weak, it's the servants, it's the downtrodden. Those are the people that God delivers. Those who persevere, those who stand strong, who stand firm, those are the ones that will be delivered by God. And again, this context, this Old Testament context, emphasizes that idea. And again, the Lord will judge His people, and it's from the same context there. And then he says in verse 31, it is a terrifying thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Now, clearly, it's not terrifying for everybody, because those who find recourse and hope and refuge in the sacrificial work of God have reason not to be terrified. But it is a terrifying thing to fall into the hands of God if there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins. And that's the context in which he's saying that. If you don't have that, if you're going to stand before God on your own merits, and that's something even Daniel wasn't willing to do. Daniel says in Daniel chapter 9, as he is praying before God, he says, God, we do not come before you because of any merits of our own, but because of your great compassion. Daniel threw himself on the mercy and compassion of God. He did not attempt to stand before God on his own merits. And so that's not a place that you want to be. That is a terrifying thing. This idea of a living God is something that's come up a lot in the book of Hebrews. Why? Let's look at some of these passages real quick. In Hebrews chapter 3, in verse 12. Take care, brethren, that there not be any one of you an evil and unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God. And in 9:14, it says, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered Him without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? And 12:22 as well. We read here, but you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God. Why does he keep emphasizing living God? Living God. Obviously, he wants us to know that God is not dead, right? Or an idol, yeah. He's living and active, to paraphrase what he said about the word in chapter 4. And I think the emphasis is actually on Christ as being the one who lives. And that is the location of life. He's not dead, he's not gone. He is alive, he is active. And he is going to realize his purposes. And so the living God is the only place where you're going to find life and hope. Don't turn away from the living God. Don't anger the living God. That's where life resides. Yeah.
Right.
He is still active. Right. Right. That's a good point. Any other thoughts? Okay, so in 32, he begins to class them with these other groups that we've talked about that have been downtrodden and oppressed. He says, remember the former days when after being enlightened, you endured a great conflict of sufferings, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, and partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. For you showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and a lasting one. Now, okay, they're being persecuted. There's, I think, certainly the risk that this persecution is going to get a lot worse. Why bring up the fact that they've been persecuted from the get-go? How is that encouraging? Okay, they've gotten through it before. That's right. And God has delivered them through this in the past. Exactly so. Somebody else.
I should say, despite the persecutions from the beginning, they still are saying they're still running all
God. Right. And so there are sort of two sides to this exhortation. On the one hand, it says to them, that God has gotten you through this in the past. God has delivered you before. And He can do it again. On the other hand, it says to them, look, you've been here before. There's a passage that we might think about in Romans chapter 5, beginning in verse 3. Paul says, not only this, but we also exult in our tribulation, knowing that tribulation brings about what? Perseverance or endurance. Exactly. And perseverance, proven character, and proven character, hope. And so there's a building process. Okay? So if you think about this in terms of running a really long distance, and let's say you're doing a half marathon, and you get to about mile 10. You've never run this far before in your life, and you get to mile 10, and you're thinking, oh, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I can do this. And you know why you're saying that? Because you don't know if you can do it. That's why you're saying that. And you might stroke out at any minute. You have no idea. So Alan's getting ready to run a half marathon, so this is sort of encouragement for him. But on your second half marathon, when you get to mile 10 and you start saying, I don't know if I can do this, then something kicks in and you say, wait a minute, I've been here before. And I felt just this miserable last time, but I got through it. I finished the race. I know I can go the distance. And so the Hebrew writer brings this up to remind them, A, of the faithfulness of God, and B, of their own perseverance. And he says, look, you've been here before. And so he's really expressing some significant confidence in them and in their ability to press on. And he talks about them showing sympathy to the prisoners and accepting joyfully the seizure of their property. So they took care of one another. And he says, you did this because you thought you were going to obtain a better possession. What's the better possession and why is it better? Right. Exactly. It's an eternal heavenly possession that no one can take away. It can't be stolen. It can't be robbed. And it's not going to decay. It's not going to fade. It's a spiritual possession. And they understood that was what they were after. And he's about to connect them to a whole lot of other people who've been after similar kinds of things. And so he says, therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has great reward. So don't quit before the end of the race. Don't get almost to the end and stop. That's crazy. You have need of endurance so that when you've done the will of God, you may receive what was promised. And then he takes us to another passage, Habakkuk chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. Let's go to Habakkuk and let's look at that. It's going to read just a little bit differently. Again, he's quoting from the Septuagint. We don't have that shrink. You won't see that shrinks back statement in the Masoretic text. But let's go back and look at that and think about the context of Habakkuk for just a minute. Because Habakkuk is, again, uniquely appropriate to their situation. Habakkuk starts out crying out. Habakkuk's a different kind of prophet because he actually, instead of a lot of the book of Habakkuk, is Habakkuk speaking to God on behalf of the righteous, instead of usually a prophet is God using the prophet to speak to the people. It's parts of this kind of reverse that. Habakkuk cries out and he says, Lord, when are you going to do something about all this wickedness? And God says, I'm going to do something about all this wickedness, and you're not going to believe it even when I tell you you're not going to believe it. I'm sending the Babylonians. And Habakkuk says, no, not the Babylonians. They're worse than we are. And they'll destroy us. And all of your promises and everything you've been trying to accomplish is going to be undone, and evil will be exalted and righteousness will be done away with. This is terrible. And he waits for God to correct him in the beginning of chapter 2. The Lord answers in verse 2. In verse 3, he says, the vision is yet for the appointed time. It hastens toward the goal and it will not fail. Though it tarries, wait for it will certainly come. It will not delay. Behold, as for the proud one, and in the context that's pointing to the Babylonians, his soul is not right within him. So God says, I know they're wicked, and I'm going to take care of that. But the righteous will live by his faith. Furthermore, wine betrays the haughty man so that he does not stay at home. He enlarges his appetite like Sheol. And so he says, the point about the righteous living by faith in Habakkuk 2 is, Habakkuk, I know things are going to be bad. I know they're bad now, and they're about to get worse. Okay, that's the same situation the Hebrews are in, right? But if you'll trust me, I'll get you through this. And everybody who is like you, I'll get them through it. But you've got to trust me. You've got to hang on. And not shrink back, as the Septuagint says, not shrink back to destruction. Don't give up. Don't quit. Hang on. Be faithful. And so again, the proud, the arrogant, the enemies, going to be dealt with. The righteous, if they'll hang on, are going to be preserved. Again, every one of these contexts, Habakkuk, Deuteronomy, Isaiah, every time it's this kind of message that's being sent. And so he pulls this context from Habakkuk once again to encourage them. There are two choices here, and there are two outcomes. Choose with wisdom. Trust God. Hang on. You can do this. You can make it. And the other thing that's really valuable about this is that, you know, Deuteronomy was written to that second generation that inherited the land. Isaiah and Habakkuk are directed to people who are about to go through Babylonian captivity. And it really looked like, from Habakkuk's perspective, that that might be the end of the nation. But was it in fact the end of the nation? No, it wasn't. God delivered them through that. And so these are powerful, powerful incentives to remember the faithfulness of God and remember that He has sustained His people through incredibly difficult, painful situations, and that God is faithful to those who continue to trust in Him. And so these contexts carry historical weight with them as well. And they evoke stories in the minds of the people who know the context. That would be people like us, right? So you read these and you say, yes, that's right, I remember now. And if that doesn't happen, then we need to work to make it happen. He says, we're not of those who shrink. Now notice again, 39, what is he doing? What outcome does he anticipate from them? According to verse 39 of chapter 10. What does he think they're going to do? Shrink back to destruction or not shrink back to destruction? Not. He expresses confidence in them again. This is another aspect of the Hebrew writing. He'll hit them pretty hard. I mean, you know, he's talked a lot about judgment, but he says, but that's not who we are. That's not going to be our outcome. He says, because I know that you guys aren't going to quit. You're not going to quit. Now, he says that after he warns them of the full and terrible consequences of quitting. Okay? It's not all sunshine and roses with the Hebrew writer. He says some tough stuff to them. But on the tail end of that tough stuff, he did the same thing in chapter 6. He says, we're confident of better things concerning you, things concerning salvation. I know you're going to make it. And he says it again. Now, there is no point in the Hebrew writer sugarcoating any of this. Because if they remain faithful, it's going to be really hard. They're being persecuted, and that's not just going to go away because they want it to. Faithfulness is going to be tough. And he doesn't come along with, oh, don't worry, everything's going to be okay, everything's going to turn out fine. There's none of that. But as tough as faithfulness is going to be, unfaithfulness is a whole lot tougher. And he doesn't sugarcoat that either. But then, having loved them enough to tell them the whole truth, then he says, I know you can do it, and I believe you will do it. And so, again, this is preaching at its finest, what we have in the Hebrew letter, sermon. It's a sermon written, but it's a sermon. And he says, we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but of those who have faith to preserving the soul. And he classes himself with them. That's not who we are. He's not adversarial about this. It's not him and them. It's not, I'm going to straighten you people out. He's in it with them. And it looks like he's writing from prison when you get to the end of it. So, there's that as well. Any other comments about chapter 10? Okay. Let's look a little bit at chapter 11, and I want to kind of look down the road at what he's going to do and challenge you to think about some things. He's asking them to have faith, and he's asking them to enter into a long tradition of faith. So they've been tempted to go back to the old covenant, and he's told them that's a dead end. But now he gives them something they can go back to. And that is a tradition of faith in God. Now, one of the things that I want to encourage you to do as we work through chapter 11 is I want you to go back, and I know I've said this over and over again, but go back and look at the accounts of some of these people. I want to just give you one example real quick. It says here, we're looking at, by faith, even Sarah herself received ability to conceive beyond the proper time of life, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Now think about that statement. Do you remember what happened in Genesis 18 when the visitors tell Abraham that Sarah's going to have a baby? What did she do? She laughed. She laughed. And not ha-ha funny laugh, but that will never happen kind of laugh. And then she's discovered and she thinks better of her laugh. But is that the sort of story that you would expect to read after hearing this? It's really not. And most of the people that he talks about, they got bumps like that. I mean, Samson and Gideon. Are you kidding me? But you know what's true of every one of them? It was messy. It was not pretty. But the thing that's true of every person he talks about is they didn't quit. And that's the point. Did they stumble? Did they make bad choices? Did they do things that were most definitely less than what God wanted, or in some cases the opposite of what God wanted? Yes, they did. But having done those things, at some point they turned it around and they were faithful to the end. And that's the thing that the Hebrew writer is trying to drive home, this idea, because, again, they're in the same position. Something these people have done has alarmed the Hebrew writer into writing this very strong letter saying, don't quit. Or, do you tell somebody, don't quit, when they're charging hard and they're saying, I got this and I'm never going to quit? No, that's not when you say don't quit. That's when you encourage them to keep going. You tell somebody not to quit when they really think about quitting. And so, and we know that some of them had quit, because he talks about forsaking the assembly. He says, as is the manner of some. Some people pulled away. And so there are some quitters and there are some thinking about quitters. And he says, he lists all these people who've got this kind of messy faith, but what they have going for them, they didn't quit. And so he's saying, in no uncertain terms with all this history, don't be a quitter. And what we're going to quit on that. Don't be a quitter. Thank you.